Good morning and welcome to this June 7th, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, although both interviews this morning have been pre-recorded. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast on iTunes and elsewhere. I'll give you more information on that later in the show. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. This week is fun, mystery, and intrigue. I'm happy to welcome Anthony Horowitz to the show this morning with his latest mystery, Magpie Murders. And in the second half, Anna Quinlan will be on with her paperback release of Miller's Crossing. Anthony Horowitz was the author of Trigger Mortis, a New York Times bestseller, Moriarty, and the international bestseller, The House of Silk, as well as the New York Times bestselling Alex Rider series for young adults. As a television screenwriter, he created Midsummer Murders and the BAFTA-winning Foyle's War, both of which were featured on PBS's Masterpiece Mystery. Speaking of masterpieces, his latest masterpiece is Magpie Murders. It's published by Harper. Anthony joins me from London to talk about it. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You might not actually be in London. I know you're in England. Are you in London?
I'm indeed in London. I'm sitting in my office, which is on the sixth floor of a building in Clerkenwell. And looking out of the window, I can see appropriately, I think, the Old Bailey just across there from me. And to the left of it is St. Paul's, and in the distance, rising up the Shard.
Ah, what a great space to write. Is that where you do your writing?
It is. This is an area which was actually frequented by many of Charles Dickens's characters. And Dickens is one of my great literary heroes. And so it's an older part of London, quite a lot of cobbled streets, a few gas lamps still left here. And it's full of atmosphere, and I do find it very inspirational.
I love it. I love it. So we're going to get into some of that, actually. But before we do that, I don't know if we're going to be able to unearth the mystery of how the hell you put this novel together, which is incredible, but we're going to try. But first, I'll give our listeners some context and insight into the novel and let you kind of take us inside a little preview of Magpie Murders.
You go ahead.
Well, you go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were going to do it yourself.
I know,
you want me to do it.
I did say that I was going to do it, but I think you'll do a better job. So I'm going to
let me begin. Magpie Murders. Well, you're right. I mean, this was a very, very difficult book to write, and one of the complexities of it was to make it easy to read, because one of the things I really don't like is a whodunit that you keep having to thumb through the pages to try and work out who characters are, where they were, how could they possibly have been in two places at once, that sort of thing. And this is a story which has two very separate mysteries which are interconnected in a very peculiar way. Let me explain. The first half of the book is a Golden Age mystery. It is almost in the style of Agatha Christie or Dorothy L. Sayers. It takes place in 1955 in an English village called Saxby-on-Avon, where there are a number of characters, one of whom is murdered, and a detective called Atticus Punt begins to investigate. And even the name, I think, will have a certain sort of echo of Hercule Poirot and detectives like that in him. He is that sort of classic Golden Age detective. However, just before you get to the solution of this murder, and you're only halfway through my book, you come to basically a blank page, and the last chapter is missing. You then cut forward into the 21st century, to the present time, to a publishing house, the publishers of the Atticus Punt Mysteries, and an editor called Susan Ryland has received the manuscript, which is missing the final chapter. She then hears that there's not going to be a final chapter because the author, Alan Conway, that is to say the author of Magpie Murders, has died. She travels to his house in order to try and find the missing pages, and in doing so she discovers two things. The first is that his own death was not natural. He has been murdered. And secondly, he is surrounded by characters whom he has used as characters in his book, and one of those characters has killed him. So, if that isn't already too confusing, she realizes that the solution to the murder of Alan Conway can be found in his book if she can find the missing chapter. And that is sort of the premise of Magpie Murders.
So great. I've never seen anything like this done before. Was there some sort of template that you had to structure this on, or this was made whole cloth from your brain?
I wanted to do a book that had never been done before. I've become increasingly interested in whodunits and in murder mysteries, and I'm looking at ways of expanding the genre or of playing with it and doing original things, and also adding to it. having written hours and hours of murder mystery on television, a series called Midsummer Murders, which I created many years ago, was followed by Foyle's War, which I also created and which I wrote something like 26 episodes of, left me feeling that it's not enough just to write a murder mystery with a, you know, even if it has a great plot and fun characters and a good twisty solution. I want to try and do something more. And that was what I was doing with Magpie Murders.
And you had conceived of this idea, I read somewhere, years and years ago. And talk a little bit about that, with the inception.
Well, actually, Murray, you know, I can prove it. Because if you look at the second episode of Midsummer Murders, which is, I think, filmed something like 25 years ago, one of the characters in that episode is reading Magpie Murders. I had that idea while I was doing that show and got the props department to mock up my book with its cover and everything and put it into the episode as a sort of a smile and a nod to my future self, if you like. It took me a very, very long time to write it because, first of all, at that time, I was only known as a writer of YA fiction, principally Alex Rider. But also, the honest truth is, I didn't think I was good enough to write it yet. I needed to establish myself as an adult author. I also needed to mature in my work and in my craft. And then I would be able to write it. And finally, something like 25 or 30 years later, I did.
And so at that time, when Magpie Murders was born in your brain, did it have the structure of a book within a book? Or talk about how that idea emerged and how you played with it.
Sure. The inspiration for Magpie Murders comes out of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle. I've always been fascinated by the fact, I've always incidentally been a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes, which is why I've written two books in his world on my own account. I've always been fascinated by the fact that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle created the greatest character in British literature, in Sherlock Holmes, this wonderful detective, and the detective was hugely popular in his own time. Those stories which appeared in Strand magazine had a vast following around the world. And what was his response to this? Was he happy? Was he proud? Was he pleased? No. He thought that Sherlock Holmes was beneath him, and he actually wanted to be writing romantic histories, such as, I mean, the books he considered to be his masterpieces, Micah Clarke and The White Company, and I'd be interested to know how many of your listeners have even heard of those books, let alone read them, because, of course, nobody has remembered them. They have simply disappeared. And I thought that was really interesting, this relationship between a writer and a detective and his readers. Doyle threw Sherlock Holmes off the Reichenbach Falls, murdered him in order to get on with his other work. It is true, of course, that later on he brought him back for financial reasons, but I was just interested in that impetus and wanted to explore it. So when, all those years ago, I thought up Magpie Murders, the story that I had in mind was a detective writer, I call him Alan Conway, who doesn't like writing detective stories. And I knew, yes, of course, it then followed, there would be a book within a book. We would see the book that he had written, the character he had created, and then I would explore his life.
Oh, I love it. I love it. My guest this morning is Anthony Horowitz. The book is Magpie Murders, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So let's dive into constructing the mystery, and I want to do this in a way, of course, that doesn't reveal anything too telling about the novel. But I think we can have sort of a generalized discussion about techniques and devices and methods that you used and other mystery writers that you've mentioned have used that can give us kind of some insights into people who may be struggling with how to write that kind of mystery. So this, as you mentioned, kind of plays homage to the golden age of mysteries, to Agatha Christie, to Doyle. And I always hear about the devices they use, but I never kind of understand what those devices entail. And I wonder if you could give language to some of those and to kind of what they are, to what Christie did particularly well, to what Doyle did particularly well, that we can kind of learn from.
Yes, so I should say that Magpie Murders does, within the book itself, certainly in the second half, in the modern part, discusses at some length, because the book is about the writing of whodunits and the techniques and the tricks and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Where I begin is this. I mean, first of all, I think of the book as a dartboard. That's what I think a murder mystery looks like. The bullseye, the red dot at the center of this, is a very, very simple equation. It is A plus B equals C. And all crime novels start with this. It is A is one person, B is another person, and C is the reason why A wants to murder B. And there aren't, funnily enough, that many reasons to do it. When it really comes down to it, it may be revenge, it may be fear, or it may be covetousness. These are the three main reasons to kill somebody in a book. And what I want to do always is to try and find an unusual, an interesting reason for somebody to want to kill somebody else. The idea is always to be original, to do things that are different. So it's not just because you want their money or because you're having an affair with their wife. There's got to be something which is more fun than that. But that is nonetheless the core. Then around that, you start to build the sort of the layers which are radiating outwards on your dartboard. And the first circle around them, if you like, would be their immediate family, the people who know them best, the people who have, in each case, another reason, perhaps, to wish to kill this person. And then each one of those people has another, as it were, satellite around them, which might now be some of the outer scores, which are their own lives, their own worlds, their own insecurities, whatever they are. Now, into this, you also have to, of course, inject, and I think this is probably the hardest part of it, an original and interesting detective, coming up with a sort of a detective who doesn't just tick boxes, i.e. he's not sort of, you know, the blind detective, the disabled detective, the tall detective, the short detective, the black detective, the white detective, but somebody who actually has something going for them and is interesting. That, of course, is a hard part of it. And then, for me, once I have got that dartboard, so I've got these characters, I've got all these different stories, I've got my central crime, then it's a case of very carefully, meticulously plotting it all out and adding in, you know, those vital ingredients of a good murder mystery, which are the clues and the red herrings and the surprises. So, you know, you want a second death if you can find a way to get one, because that, I think, always piques interest and keeps people involved in the story. And to do this, I take effectively copious notes. I mean, I have pages and pages and pages of diagrams, of questions to myself, of ideas for things. I had one this morning. Somebody is killed in a hotel, and their room card is, their room number is 616. And so a clue is this card, which is 616. And it just occurred to me while I was walking the dog that this is quite fun, that actually the murderer has murdered the wrong person because he had the card upside down and actually intended to murder the person in room 919. Now, that's sort of silly, and I'll probably never use it, but it's that little sort of thing that comes to mind that I then pin, as it were, to my dartboard and work into the story. You know, whose pocket is that card found in? How does it actually appear in the story? And how does the detective realize what has happened? And, of course, in that idea is the second murder I've just talked about, because the first murder is a mistake. The second person, the person in room 919, then gets killed later in the story. That's how it works.
It always strikes me that it's so difficult. It would be so difficult to be original in a mystery. There's so many mysteries that have been written. And as you say, you really need to be smarter than the reader, be smarter than all of these other mystery writers with all of this body of work out there, and come up with very original, unique storylines. And I wonder, I kind of wonder what you draw from, if you feel like this bubbles up from your subconscious, if you draw from other literature out there to inspire your ideas, kind of where these germs come from.
Well, for me, first of all, I never think of myself as cleverer than the reader. I think if the voice of the book comes over as I'm cleverer than you, the reader is not going to enjoy it. I think one of the joys of detective fiction is that the reader and the detective and the writer all sort of stand shoulder to shoulder in the pursuit of truth and such. So, yes, Atticus Punt, Sherlock Holmes, certainly, and Poirot can be incredibly annoying because they are cleverer than us. But the writer and the sidekick, who is an essential part of this, the sidekick, Dr. Watson or Hastings or whoever, who is almost the sort of the voice of the reader and the writer, it becomes terribly important in this. In terms of the other half of your question you must remind me what the second half of your question was.
Well, just whether this bubbles up from your subconscious, whether you draw from
the inspiration. For me, the inspiration comes from various sort of places. I would say my first inspiration is magic tricks. I'm fascinated by illusion, by sleight of hand, by trompe l'oeil, by illusion of every sort. I do magic tricks. I never do them publicly. I'm not good enough. But I do like playing with cards and coins and learning the moves and understanding. Now, in fact, Moriarty, the whole murder mystery of Moriarty, is based on a specific card trick, the mechanism that makes that book work. Less so in our Magpie Murders, but nonetheless, I love misdirection and such things. I also like crosswords. I like word plays. I do the Times crossword every day, and I love cryptic clues. So I like sort of things that make you smile, really. Anything that you have around you can be molded into a murder mystery if you have the right mind for it. I mean, as I speak to you, I'm looking at a pot of ink in a box, and I could turn that very easily into a clue in a murder mystery. If there was a thumbprint on it, which had ink, but the ink was a different color to the ink that was in the bottle inside, that would be telling a story. What story would it be telling, and how could I use that story to illustrate the death, shall we say, of a writer in his office? It's that sort of thing. And if it makes me smile, and I think it's going to, on the one hand, play fair with the reader, but at the same time beguile them, like a good magic trick, then I use it.
I love the way your brain works. I wish my brain worked.
Thank you.
This is wonderful. My guest this morning is Anthony Horowitz. The book is Magpie Murders. There's such a rich tradition of murder mysteries set in England. And I feel like the setting is so integral to this. And I feel like this, it's just such a visceral place that worms its way into you. And I wonder if you can speak to what it is about England, what it is about this tradition of English writers that we associate with the mystery, and maybe why that is.
Well, this is, again, something that I do discuss vaguely inside Magpie Murders, and it is something that I wonder about. I can't tell you, I can't pretend that I have, you know, definite answers to your question, but I do sometimes think that it runs along these lines. Caroline Graham, I mentioned that I helped to create Midsummer Murders, but of course they were actually based on books written by a brilliant writer called Caroline Graham, and I think she got it right. Her book, sincerely, she called Agatha Christie on acid. I love that description. And what she had drawn were these incredible English villages with their, you know, perfect lawns and backyards and the village pond and the village pub and thatched cottages and little old ladies on tricycles, everything you imagine an English village looks like. And then behind the lace curtains are these absolutely wicked acts of and depraved acts going on, and everybody has something to hide. And I think she sort of nailed the particular charm of the English murder mystery, and it is this, that we are a very small island, and our villages are even smaller. In a village, everybody knows everybody else. Everybody is connected in some way, and not always in a very good way. So, you know, if there is an affair happening, or if there is lust, if there are any of the sort of seven deadly sins, greed, gluttony, and envy, and all the rest of them, whatever, you know, there are people whom you can connect together. At the same time, we are, I think, as an island race, very much more reserved than you Americans. You tend to be much more upfront with your emotions. You say it how it is. You don't hold back. We tend to be much more reserved in the way that if we hate somebody, we will keep it to ourselves. We will let it brew. William Blake wrote a poem about it, The Poison Tree. And all of us, I think, in Britain have a poison tree growing inside us of envy or of jealousy or of whatever. And I think that is why the murder mystery is so well-suited to my country, and it is that combination of intimacy, closeness, smallness, and reservedness, and that can be quite a potent mix.
Indeed, indeed. How much of this book surprised you as you were writing it? How much of this revealed itself to you in the writing as opposed to in the plotting as you were constructing it, you know, kind of before the writing process took place?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised. In fact, I might say I was hugely relieved that it all worked when I finally got to the end, because I felt as if I had like 100 different wires in each hand, like some kind of telephone engineer, and I had to connect the whole lot together in the last few pages. And to my astonishment, they all did connect and such. I don't like surprises when I'm writing, to be honest with you. I plan everything so carefully that if I find myself going off at a tangent, I get quite nervous about it and want to get back into my comfort zone. I think that I was pleasantly surprised how smooth it was to write this book, that every time I got to the end of a chapter, I knew exactly where I was going next, not just because I had a structure already sort of in the notebooks that I mentioned, but because there was a sort of a logical quality to the whole book, that there was nowhere else to go, and I always knew that I was going in the correct direction. As I sit here, in fact, this afternoon, I've been working on the television version of Magpie Murders. A company in Britain has bought it, the same company that made Foyle's War, in fact, and want me to do a televised version of it. And I'm finding the same thing, that although I am moving quite a long way away from the book, as I begin to sit here and structure, which has been my work of the afternoon, the scenes have that sort of logical quality. And it was interesting, earlier in this conversation, you talked about some of your listeners who maybe struggle with struggle putting together a whodunit or any other form of book. And it's always been my sort of rule for myself that if I'm struggling, if I'm floundering, if I'm blocked, then something has gone seriously wrong. For me, writing has always got to have a sort of an inevitability about it, a smoothness, an ease almost. I don't use the words ease or difficulty, but I do respond to this sense of everything is going well. And if it isn't, then I don't write because something about the book is out of kilter.
Yes, right, right. How important to you is character development to a mystery? I mean, it feels like mysteries are so plot-driven, plot-central, but I know to make the plot intriguing and invest the reader in the characters, and there's such a wide, rich, wonderful cast of characters here, you need to spend a lot of time with those characters. And I'm wondering how you go about that, how you keep track of their backstory, of their motives, of their relationships, and make them, you know, a rich a village of people.
Well, I think character is everything. I mean, that's the absolute truth of it. I mean, I think that, you know, Agatha Christie has been criticized for having fairly, shall we say, not hugely developed characters. They do sometimes tend to feel a little bit sort of, I don't know what the word is. I'm a huge fan of hers. So I don't want to say anything that is negative about her work. And I don't agree with it anyway. I think she does write very good characters. But in Magpie Murders, there are two sets of characters. It's interesting. In the 1955 part of the book, the characters are a little, not obvious, but they are, you know, they're the vicar, the doctor, the antique dealer, the people you'd expect to find living in a village. In the second half of the book, which is set in the modern world, where you have characters who include the editor, her publisher, her assistant, and such, the characters have a very different feel to them. They are slightly more realistic in a way, are less, you know, obvious characters in a whodunit. And I enjoyed drawing up both sets of characters and being aware of the differences. The most important characters in the book for me were the detective and his sidekick, and they were the ones I spent longest thinking about. I mentioned earlier that Atticus Punt has certain sort of echoes of Hercule Poirot, but what I tried very hard to do was to give him a sense of depth and a sense of reality. And I did that by, first of all, having him a refugee from the concentration camps at the end of the war, the fact that he is already Greek-German, a Greek who has emigrated to Germany before the war, and because he's also Jewish, then finds himself caught up in it in a very terrible way. And also by giving him a book, I was very pleased with this idea I had that he's writing a book called Landscapes of Criminal Investigation, and that this is sort of his entire life's work is contained in this volume. Suddenly, to me, he became a real person, not just a sort of a collection of mannerisms. And I think that, you know, especially for a modern audience, I'm not writing for a 1950s audience, I'm writing for a very sophisticated modern audience who sees hours of very, very high quality television, and who reads wonderful thrillers that are out there, both in America and in the UK, and therefore will not accept, I think, you know, stereotypes and shallow characters. So with all the characters, but particularly with the detectives, and with Susan Ryland, who is the editor who investigates the second half, I invested an awful lot of time and care to make sure that they lived and breathed on the page.
Indeed, indeed. And that, which kind of leads me into my next question about voice. The book has, obviously, written in two parts, has two distinct voices, even reflected in the typeface, which, you know, we have the manuscript that she's reading in a certain typeface and the rest of it in another. So talk a little bit about voice, because you really need to establish very distinct voices in the novel. And switching, and whether or not that gave you any difficulty, kind of how you access those two very distinct voices.
Well, of course, it is interesting that the first half of the book is supposedly written not by me, but by a writer that I created, who I haven't talked about, Alan Conway, who is not a particularly pleasant man, and who I hope is nothing at all like me. I've asked my editors, you don't think I'm like Alan Conway, do you? And they assure me that I'm not, which is good. And so I was creating characters through Alan, which was interesting, unlike the characters in the modern novel, who are my own characters. You're talking about voices. I have learned literary ventriloquism because I have written in the style twice of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and I'm now at the moment writing a second James Bond novel in the voice of Ian Fleming. So I am quite used to adopting other people's voices. And the first half of the novel, I don't think it is written in the style of Agatha Christie or with her voice. It uses some of her tropes. So, for example, the foreign detective with a sidekick who is English, I guess, is vaguely Agatha Christie. Certainly, the nursery rhyme, Magpie Murders, refers to the number of magpies you might see in a field. And there's an old English nursery rhyme. I don't know if you have it in America. One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl, four for a boy, five for silver, six for gold, seven for a secret never to be told. Mm-hmm. And Agatha Christie used nursery rhymes throughout her work, Hickory Dickory Dock, and then there were none, Five Little Pigs, etc., etc. So I'm using some of her techniques, and I acknowledge this in the name of the writer I have, Alan Conway, shares her initials. But I don't think I'm using her language. The language of this book is much more my own, and certainly in the second half, where we're in the modern age, there is no attempt to be writing as somebody else. And, it is high time I started writing original novels because, although I have thoroughly enjoyed doing three what are called continuation novels, I also rather fancy having my own voice.
I wonder if you take any of your skills, anything you brought over from your work in young adult fiction. Certainly, I can see a lot of your screenwriting work at work in this novel. What you have drawn from the past that you think translated well into the mystery?
Well, thank you for that. It's a kind question. I think that making a transition from children's author to adult author is a difficult one, and it's something that many writers stumble over. I think if I have succeeded at it, it's because I've never seen them as being that different, curiously. When I write an Alex Rider book, I'm interested in story, effectively. I think the power of story to grip, to hold our attention, to make us forget the outside world. I think I've said in the past that writing for kids, you have to imagine a pair of hands coming out of the book, grabbing the reader by the throat and refusing to let them go until they get to the last page. That's also true, I think, very much so, of my television writing. Television is wonderful to write for, but I'm very aware that there are many other temptations in the house. There's a kitchen, let's have a coffee, let's go to bed early, let's go out, you know. I want my audience to stay watching, whether it's an episode of, you know, Midsummer Murders or Foyle or whatever. So this sort of desire, you know, to write page turners, to write cliffhangers, to make sure that the attention never wanders, to keep surprising, to keep people excited and interested. That, I think, is what goes through all my writing. And I'm not sure that I learned it in my adult writing for my kids' writing or vice versa. It's just something I've always done.
And something you do so well. I mean, I really feel like the moment you open this book, and I kind of attributed it even to the shorter sentence structure, it's so engaging and so immersive. And, you know, it really is a page-turner, both because of the plot and because of the characters. But I think also the writing style, too, is very accessible, very just easy to fall into.
You're very kind, but I will say that to me, language is something which I very much love. I mean, I read Charles Dickens, I read Jane Austen, and Anthony Trollope. Most of my writing, most of my great loves in writing are 19th century, as it happens. And one thing these writers had was that no matter what type of story they were writing, whether it was, you know, Dickens at his most comic, or Trollope at his most profound, or Jane Austen at her most sort of elegant. Their use of language is always so delightful, so that you could read their books time and time again and just delight in the sentences that they put in front of your eyes. And most of the writers that I like, you know, are not just great storytellers, they're great linguists. And I do try in my own books to write well, because I think it's, you know, because language is such a beautiful thing. If used correctly, it can be so, the cadence of a sentence, the way the words fall on the ear, the rhythm of it, I think it's all part of the pleasure of reading.
And as we stress to our listeners all the time, the importance of reading. I hear from so many writers who say, I don't have time to read, or what was the last book you read? They say, I just don't have the time to do that. And that really is part of the most important part of the craft, is reading wide, reading deep. Going back to the classics, I think Charles Dickens is such a wonderful writer to return to again and again for all the lessons.
But it's what brings us together. It's, you know, our humanity, all of civilization can be found in fiction. If we want to understand who we are, where we've come from, where we're going, and how we relate to each other, we need to read. And we won't find it, I think, in 24-hour news. We're certainly not going to find it in world politics, not at the moment. And, you know, you're talking to me in England just days after we've had yet another terrible atrocity in Manchester now, and you think to yourself that we have to come together as a race. It is, we have to find ways to reach out to each other and to understand each other, and books seem to me to be the most accessible, the easiest. For heaven's sake, you know, you don't even need to pay for a book. They're free in libraries, they're all around us. By reading and by reading widely, we will understand each other and fear each other less.
Indeed. That is the importance of so many important things about literature. That is the importance of literature. Anthony Horowitz, this was such a pleasure. The book is brilliant.
Well, you're very, very kind. It's been a real pleasure talking to you as well. And I think it's fantastic, incidentally, that, you know, you can have a radio station that is so dedicated to books and talks to writers like me for such a lengthy period of time. It's I wish we had more of them here.
So do I. Yeah, I love this show, and I love having writers like you on. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Anthony Horowitz. The book is Magpie Murders. It is out and available now. It is published by Harper's. That is all the time we have for. We're going to take a very short break. Anna Quinlan will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes under College Radio, or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads. There are 19 years, almost 20 years of shows up there for your listening pleasure. Past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events that we have going on, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Anna Quinlan is a novelist and journalist whose work has appeared on fiction, nonfiction, and self-help bestseller lists. She's the author of 8 novels. Her memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, was published in 2012. It was a #1 New York Times bestseller. She was on the show with me chatting about that. Can't believe it's been 5 years. Her book, A Short Guide to a Happy Life, has sold more than 1 million copies. While a columnist at the New York Times, she won the Pulitzer Prize and published 2 collections, Living Out Loud and Thinking Out Loud. Her Newsweek columns were collected in Loud and Clear, but it's her latest novel we're talking about today. It's Miller's Valley. At last, it is out in paperback. It's published by Random House, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Anna, welcome back.
I'm so glad to be back with you.
I love having you on. This is great. I tried to get you on for the hardback, but you were too busy. So I am very excited to have you on for the paperback.
Thanks.
I'm going to let you introduce the novel for people who somehow haven't yet read it, and take us into Miller's Valley and maybe talk about kind of the original inspiration for the book.
Sure. Miller's Valley is based in a small farming community out in the middle of nowhere. I'm purposefully a little vague about it in the novel, in part because I don't like to nail readers down too much. And I find it enormously satisfying when, as happened on the hardcover tour, people come up to me and say, oh, you know, I'm from the town in California that's the basis for Miller's Valley, or I'm from the town in Illinois, or the town in Pennsylvania, or the town in upstate New York. Miller's Valley is one of those places. It's really just a wide place in the road, but it has the misfortune of being kind of wet a lot of the time. And what that means is that the government has plans for it involving a dam and a future reservoir. And this novel takes place beginning in the 1950s and ending in the present day, and it centers around the Miller family of Miller's Valley, and particularly Mimi Miller, who grows to adulthood during the course of the book and who watches her family and her community morph and change in, I think, many of the same ways that Americans watch their country morph and change between 1950 and the present day.
Our country has morphed and changed since yesterday. So we'll get into that in a minute, though. So talk about the door into the novel. Did it start with an image? Did it start with one of these characters? Was it a situation? Tell me a little bit about the very original thing that took you into it.
You know, when I was a reporter, someone once said very wisely to me that when we covered presidential elections, we were always really covering the last election. And what they meant was whatever shortcomings we'd had, whatever issues we'd missed, whatever balance we hadn't managed to strike 4 years before, we would be revisiting when we took up the presidential race again. And I say that because, to a certain extent, most novelists, I think, and certainly I, am reacting in some measure to my last book when I start a new one. I had a progression here of a novel called Every Last One, which was a family story that was extremely dark and felt about as dark as I ever wanted to go. And so when I wrote my next book, Still Life with Breadcrumbs, I determined that it was going to be both a love story and a novel with a happy ending, neither one of which I'd ever done before. So that when I finally turned to Miller's Valley, I realized that one of the things I'd never done was a really American novel, a novel that's really about who we are and where we come from. And that was my original impulse with this book. I think the years that this novel covers are the years after World War II, when Americans slowly by inches began to realize that their government might not have their best interests at heart. Mm. And certainly that's where the people in Miller's Valley wind up when the government is so anxious to put their community under under 30 or 40 feet of water. It's also a time when the lives of women changed fairly radically in the United States, and in fact all over the world, but very notably here. And certainly that's what Mimi's story arc reflects. But I'm never able to write from theme. Theme really interests me. It's obviously something I've dealt with a lot as a writer, since for many years I was an opinion columnist, and a good column has to have a theme. As a novelist, I'm grounded almost 100% in character. And so when I really start when the motor really starts to run on a novel for me is when I have a protagonist in my mind and he or she starts to take a specific shape. And so thinking about all those themes, it was only when I had a handle on Mimi Miller and the part of her life that I was going to cover and the kind of person she was that I really was able to move forward with the book in a convincing way.
I think it's always interesting to think about the world that books are born into. And I assume the writing of this took place during the Obama administration. The hardcover came out during the book came out during the campaigning. The paperback is obviously coming out now.
Right.
And you know, where a few weeks ago or months ago, I've kind of lost track of political time, the government was talking about taking people's land to build a border wall, which, you know, still may or may not happen. And women are now threatened with losing their reproductive rights all over again. Everything old kind of feels new again. And what felt like historical fiction, maybe when you were writing this, some of the other generations, you know, some other generations' problems are now our generation's problems all over again. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, on the, you know, that this book feels so much more relevant than maybe it felt even when you were writing it.
Well, that's interesting. Although I do tend, as a reporter, to think that there really is nothing new under the sun, and that, you know, demagoguery can always come back into fashion, and the government can always relearn how to follow what I consider its worst impulses. So actually, when I was working on Miller's Valley and thinking about some of these themes of government intervention into people's lives, they didn't seem terribly distant to me. I mean, they seemed quite contemporary and real, even though they were taking place in the 60s and 70s. I mean, you know, one of the aspects of the Miller's life that's reflected here is the fact that Tommy Miller, who really has no conceivable future once he graduates from high school, decides to enlist and winds up in Southeast Asia, which really breaks him as a human being. I don't see that as very different from the guys who went to the Gulf and came back with PTSD, and I'm sure it won't be very different than guys and women who may be sent abroad in wars, what I would consider benighted wars, in the years to come. You know, one of the things about Americans is that we tend to live in the now, which means that we often don't learn the lessons of history. And boy, do I feel that right now. And boy, will that not surprise me if it happens over and over again.
Do you think that's a uniquely American phenomenon, or do you think that's human nature? It does seem uniquely American, and I can't figure out why that is. But
oh, because we're like the teenage country of the world. I mean, No, but really, I mean, when you go to London and someone says to you, well, last night I was at the New York Philharmonic, and the violin soloist was playing a Stradivarius that was made in 1732, I believe the year was. Hmm. Now, in 1732, the United States hadn't even gotten going yet. And over in Europe, you know, they were acquiring spectacular violins. So, you know, you walk around the streets of London or Paris or Prague, and you walk past a building that was built, you know, during the Renaissance or in the 1600s, and you just think America is a very, very young country. And you know what? There are great advantages to being a teenager. That kind of vigor you have, that kind of sense of everything happening for the first time, that wide-eyed, sometimes idealistic view of the world. But there are downsides to it too. And I think in this country it is that we seem to ricochet from one side of any situation or issue to another. And I certainly think, you know, we're living through that now.
We have all the hubris of teenagers and all of the I know it all qualities when we don't know much, I think.
Yes. Yes, we do. Or some of us do.
Yeah. Some of us more than others, right? Are you regretting the name Donald in the book now and his golf affliction?
No, I'm not. You know, it's funny with characters. My first novel had a very unpleasant Irish Catholic patriarch in it named John Scanlon. And his name was John Scanlon because, in my mind, his name was John Scanlon. Names are not mutable to me. That's why my name on my birth certificate is Anna Quinlan, and my name after I got married was Anna Quinlan. And then I was out and about, and I ran into someone I'd known for many years whose name was John Scanlon. And he said, what did you do there? And I thought, It never even occurred to me. And in the new novel I've written, the protagonist, or her first name is Nora, and my agent's best friend is Nora, was Nora. And I said, you know, I didn't even think of that. And she said, that's okay. You know, I understand how this works. So, you know, people have names, and sometimes they get shared with people I don't like as well as others.
Right. Names are really important, I think. And you're right. I think.
Well, I think there's a very strange thing, though, that happens to you when you're writing a novel, which is really, people say to you all the time, how did you decide to do? How did you decide to set this in a rural community? How did you decide to name her Mimi? How did you decide that her brother would go to Vietnam? And because you don't want to sound ridiculously mystical about what we do, because at some level it is just pushing the rock of noun and verb uphill, you don't tell the truth about that in public settings, which is deciding doesn't really feel like the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
There's this constant discovery of, oh, that's her name, or, oh, that's where they live, or, oh, that's what they do next. That doesn't feel like a decision at all. It feels like it comes up out of the ground like water. And I think if you, when I read books where, in which someone seems to have decided to have characters do something, it always feels false. I mean, you know, the irony for someone who was once a reporter is that a novel is only good if it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only true if what happens in it and the people in it and even the names of the people in it grow somehow organically out of some view of this complete world that you're creating, all of which sounds ridiculously mystical, and I'm sorry, but it really is the fact.
And I think that's the frustration for new writers is, you know, unlike calculus or, you know, an algebra class or a history class, they want to know the answer. How do I do this? This looks really hard. Tell me how you do it. And you're right. You can't.
It's the very worst part about doing a master class on creative writing with really smart students,
right?
Because really smart students have become unbelievably invested in the right answer. You know, they're people who are used to getting A's. They're people who are used to acing tests. And so when you pull them into a venue in which the right answer may be, as I just said in the commencement speech, the wrong answer, in which the flying leap honorable failure may be infinitely more useful than the careful little paint-by-numbers paragraph, it makes them very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it really takes them out of their comfort zone. So that, you know, one of the things you have to teach them is that good writing is always about getting out of a comfort zone. I mean, you look at, for example, William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. I mean, I don't know how he had the audacity to write that novel. It's so far out of not only his comfort zone, anyone's comfort zone as a novelist at the time. In fact, all of the really great breakthrough novels are outside of some comfort zone. I mean, when you look at the break between Sir Walter Scott and Lawrence Stern's Clarissa and Pamela, and then suddenly Pride and Prejudice,
yeah,
which is a deeply naturalistic novel at some level, you think Jane Austen just took a flying leap here, and the flying leap is how really interesting fiction is born.
And yet there are, I'm sure, landfills filled with books that also tried to take flying leaps that just landed.
Yeah, I know. Well, that always is the danger, isn't it?
Right. And I think the other thing writers want to know is, you know, do I have it? Whatever that, now that it's mystical and now that we know it's, you know, kind of magic, then that puts it in the realm of talent. And what they really want to know is, do I got this or do I not? And, you know, should I apply to medical school or should I keep going?
Well,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. That's why The other thing that you have to communicate to students is that once they've reached some basic proficiency with words, writing is really about confidence. It's not about putting words together. It's about looking down at the page and thinking what you just said. I got this, thinking this is interesting. This is engrossing. I'm in this world. And there are so many voices in your head saying, well, this isn't as good as your last one. Well, this isn't as good as that book you read last week. Well, this isn't as good as, you know, that you just, a huge part of doing this is managing to still the naysayers that are between your ears.
Right, right. Isn't that true? And writers have so many of those. I mean, probably everybody does, but writers seem to have a disproportionate number of those in their head than anyone else.
Well, and also because you're getting, most of the time until publication, you're getting so little positive reinforcement. I mean, one of the great things about writing a column was that when I was doing it, say, for the Times, I had two a week. So, you know, I could have a column in on Wednesday that I thought was really crackerjack and, you know, hear crickets on Thursday from readers and friends alike. And then I think, well, I got another one coming on Saturday, and boy, are they going to love this one. And you did get that immediate gratification. With a novel, you spend years, you know, working away on it without having anybody's judgment except your own. At least for me. I mean, I know there are people who, like, will take their first six chapters and give them to their best friend or their spouse or something like that. I can't bear that. I no one reads a book I'm working on until I've finished a first draft, and the only two people who read it then are my agent and my editor.
That's smart. I do think people show their work too soon, and then somehow the magic gets drained out of it from whatever comments or feedback they get. I do think that's a risk.
I do, also, I think I'm uncomfortable with feedback from people I love. I know that sounds kind of weird, but they could be wrong, but I would take them more seriously than I might take someone else, because I do love them. I mean, my eldest child, for example, does the final copy edit with the first pass pages on my books, because by that time I can't even stand to be in the same room with them. And he's a really good, he's a real crack grammarian. I mean, he would never misspell anything on Twitter in a million years. And he's also extremely well-read. But he and I have quite different, he zigs and I zag. I love Edith Wharton. He thinks that she's sentimental and self-indulgent. He loves Joseph Conrad. I think he's kind of cold. I adore Middlemarch. He goes for Moby Dick. So Quinn might have some real strong opinions about one of my novels, and I would take them very seriously because I take him so seriously, but I'm not sure they're opinions I should listen to given the difference in the way we approach fiction.
Yep, right, right. I know what you mean. My guest this morning is Anna Quinlan. The book is Miller's Valley, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. It feels like Miller's Valley is, you know, it took place in the 50s or across time, but it feels a little bit like Trump land. And I think the importance of fiction is a leap of empathy, giving a leap of empathy to your readers, and maybe that for you as writer as well. And I wondered if this novel gave you that, if you felt like this was a place that you now, I think you live in New York, so if this was a place that you now have more empathy for, places in our country that I feel like I'm losing empathy for myself, how this changed the way you might feel about big swaths of our nation.
You know, I had a gift along those lines that most people don't have, and that I can never be grateful enough for, and that's being a reporter. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, being a reporter not only made me a better writer, but it made me a better human. And that was because I spent a lot of time with people that I wouldn't normally meet. You know, some of them surprisingly like me despite very, very different circumstances. Some of them not at all like me, but likable or understandable. So that empathy factor was writ large in a lot of my work as a newspaper reporter, and I certainly think I carried it into my novels. I mean, you know, even some of the characters that I don't particularly care for in my novels are always people who are understandable to me at some level. There's a character in this novel who in today's parlance might be called Mimi's frenemy. Her name is LaRonda. I don't like almost anything about her, but I understand exactly where she's coming from and what motivates her. And frankly, I'm not sure that you can that you can write characters that you outright revile, because then they feel a little bit like paper tigers.
Yeah.
And so there's an empathy factor that I bring to all the characters in my books that I think is invaluable.
Who gave you the most trouble in this book? It might have been LaRonda, but characters that you just had a hard time figuring out, that you had a hard time accessing, that they did things that maybe you couldn't understand.
Actually, I would say in all of my novels that probably the person that I have to work at hardest is my protagonist. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge Dickens fan, and I think if you look at any of Dickens' novels, the secondary characters are about as vivid as they come. And the characters at the center of the novel tend to be a little opaque. And maybe that's just the nature of the beast. But, you know, I didn't have any trouble accessing Tommy Miller. I mean, he seemed as real to me as anybody I knew. Or Mimi's mother, Miriam Miller. But sometimes I had to really work hard to calibrate Mimi, who's flatter and more introverted than I am. I mean, especially this book is written in the first person. I think of my 8 novels, maybe 3 of them are. I know Black and Blue is. I think 3 of them are. And when you're writing in the first person, you have to be writing in the voice of that character. There are times when you feel yourself slipping into your own voice, and you've got to fix that.
Right, right. And what I really have enjoyed about your novels is some big social issue that we all can relate to, juxtaposed with a very intimate personal story that we also all can relate to, that, you know, these characters are grounded both in their own real private intimate lives and in something bigger than themselves. And it seemed like a quiet novel with so much going on. It still had sort of a quiet center to me. I really appreciated that.
Oh, thanks so much. I steal all of that from Dickens. I mean, every single book is a rip-roaring novel that stands on its own at the same time that it has a huge social justice component that Dickens seamlessly evokes throughout the book.
It is so funny because Anthony Horowitz was on in the first half hour and raving about Dickens. Dickens is his favorite author. So it's funny that Dickens is playing a strong theme today. I love that. Sadly, we are drawing down on our time, which I always hate. I have about 80 more questions. But advice for writers that are struggling through either novel number 1 or novel number 8, what do you tell them to sustain them?
I wish I was that wise. I have one little trick. I have one little trick that I use that people have told me they find very useful. So I'll pass that along because I find it so excruciating to write, and especially to start every morning. So when I knock off at the end of a day, I don't knock off ever at the end of a chapter, and I don't even knock off at the end of a paragraph. I don't knock off at the end of a sentence. I knock off in mid-sentence. Because when I come back the next morning, if I had to start a new chapter, I would be lost. I mean, I would run straight for the television set and whatever's on the DVD or the DVR. But I can always finish a sentence that I've already started the day before. And if I finish that first sentence frequently, it kickstarts me into the next one, and then I'm off to the races.
That's real. That's pretty real. Awesome. And you're a runner and a walker, I know, too.
Yeah, I do a lot of writing when it looks like I'm actually taking part in aerobic exercise. And sometimes my lips do move. And, you know, the great thing is most of the time I'm in New York City, and when you're running and your lips are moving, no one looks twice at you because they think you're either on a really tiny Bluetooth phone, you're an actor preparing for a role, or you have certain cognitive issues that they don't want to explore.
I love it. Love it. Anna Quinlan, this was such a huge pleasure.
Well, let's do it on the next book, too.
I would love that.
Okay.
Thanks so much for taking the time.
Bye-bye.